Guardian Unlimited.
It's a weighty book, large in size. And as we open the book, the first thing we find is the title page, Master William Shakespeare's Comedies, Histories and Tragedies, published according to the true original copies. And then below that, the engraving by Martin Drewsoot of Shakespeare, that familiar engraving with his great domed head. And opposite, a poem by his friend and rival Ben Jonson, saying that this is a very fine picture of Shakespeare. London, printed by Isaac Jaggard and Edward Blunt, 1623.
It's weird when books have an aura, but this one definitely does. You sense it as soon as you enter the room. It's a kind of quiet buzz in the background. It thrums. I could be imagining it. As I walk towards the table on which it sat, I can't look at anything else. All right, it's all getting a bit silly, but when it comes to Shakespeare's first folio, things do get a bit silly. It's not even a manuscript. Shakespeare himself died 7 years before it was published. But, even so, a pristine copy of the folio went for $3.5 million a few years ago. A few years before that, someone else stole another copy, probably to order, from Durham University. As I stand here, I wonder if it'll be the most expensive book I've ever touched. Then it occurs to me, touching might actually be out of the question.
Now, that phrase, published according to the true original copies, is really important because that is the publishers and editors of the first folio saying, yeah, you may have read some of Shakespeare before in these little volumes called quartos, but the texts of those quartos were not always reliable. What we've got here is the authentic text, the true original copy.
And that's the really exciting thing about the first.
I'm standing here in the library of the Shakespeare Centre in Stratford with editor Jonathan Bate, who's just finished the mammoth task of editing the first folio for a modern audience. I'm wondering what makes the book so special. Apparently, it's all due to the text.
The quartos have a good quality text that may well be based on Shakespeare's working manuscript, or at least a close copy of it. But we don't have any evidence as to whether or not they were authorised for publication. But the folio comes with an elaborate apparatus of authority about it. It has an address to the reader describing Shakespeare's habits of composition, speaking about the authority of these texts in comparison with the earlier printed versions, and signed John Heming, Henry Condell.
In this podcast, we're going to tell the story of the first folio, from its earliest life in the printing houses and bookshops of 17th century London, to the new edition inspired by it, the first time the first folio has been edited in its own right in nearly four centuries. We'll hear from Michael Boyd, head of the RSC, who are co-sponsoring this new edition of the text, about what the first folio means to the company's actors. And we'll speak to his colleague, Deborah Shaw, who's directing the company's Complete Works season. But back to Jonathan, who's telling me the story behind the folio.
The origin of the project to collect Shakespeare's works seems to go back to the year 1619, shortly after Shakespeare's death, when a publisher called Thomas Pavier published an unauthorised edition of 10 Shakespeare plays, and it looks as though he was trying to build his own collected Shakespeare. And the players went to the Earl of Pembroke to get the project stopped. And that seems to have been the moment that they saw really they needed to do their own authorised edition. So the three of them who began the project were Richard Burbage, the leading actor and Shakespeare's closest friend in the theatre world, together with Heming and Condell. Burbage died very shortly afterwards, leaving Heming and Condell to carry the project forward.
What was their background? Did they have much experience in publishing?
No, they didn't. No, they were actors in the company. Heming's by this time was sort of fulfilling the role of business manager in the company. Probably, I suspect, he had given up acting by this time. But no, they were absolutely men of the theatre. So it was a new thing for them to be involved with an authorised edition. A very complicated process. They had to gather together the texts of a large number of plays, some of which had been published in questionable versions, others of which had never been published before. So the first thing that had to be done, they had to find the scripts, and usually that meant getting the so-called prompt books from backstage at the theatre, getting them copied out. Meanwhile, they got a consortium of publishers to take the project on, and that consortium had to set about getting the licence to print those plays that had previously appeared. And then the printing process itself. In the 17th century printing house, you know, we're not talking about computer keyboards or anything here. We're talking about men picking out every individual letter from a case of type and sticking it upside down on a stick, and then building up the page, and then a page run off the press, proofread, corrected, and then eventually multiple copies run off and the binding taking place. Possibility of a lot of errors, but actually considering this is a book of nearly 1,000 pages in double column, nearly 1 million words of Shakespeare, it's remarkable how accurate it is.
You know that actors who had actually worked with Shakespeare as playwright in residence and probably an actor and a director as well, compiled the text, so you know it's intimately connected with his intentions. It feels a wee bit more like the author's cut to some extent as well.
It's the one that his actors believed in, or that came from their actors. And, you know, not that I'm saying you can trust actors completely, but I think they are the closest to how it was performed.
In a way, the most interesting thing about this book is the care that has been taken by the men who produced it to present Shakespeare as both a man of the theatre and an author to be read. So on the one hand, in making a decision about what versions of the plays to print, they nearly always preferred the version based on the prompt book in the theatre rather than the version based on Shakespeare's original working manuscript. And in the case of those plays that had been previously printed in a little quarto format in a good quality text, they didn't simply reprint the quarto, which would have been the easy thing to do, but they carefully compared it with the theatre prompt book. They added in stage directions. So there is a whole sort of apparatus there saying, these are plays for performance, these are texts that come from the theatre.
I mean, just to say a little bit more about those text, because this is of course the kind of delight and the headache for modern editors of Shakespeare such as yourself, that there is no such thing as one single text that which Shakespeare signed off, or even if there was, things have happened to them. What's the difference between Shakespeare's working manuscripts and this finished book? What were the kind of stages between the two?
I mean, we've got here some examples of Hamlet in its different forms. I mean, if we just look at these, I think you can begin to see the process.
So we have several quarto versions, these sort of pocket-sized paperback almost, I guess.
Yeah, that's right. And they were cheap. They only cost sixpence. So the first version to be published, it's called The Tragical History of Hamlet, Prince of Denmark by William Shakespeare, as it hath been divers times acted by his highness servants in the city of London, as also in the two universities of Cambridge and Oxford and elsewhere. So this is purporting to be the performance text. And it's actually quite a short play. It's only about 2,000 lines, to about 2 hours, which is roughly the length that you would have expected a play to be at the time. But the text here seems to have been reported or reconstructed by the actors, because although it's got the kind of shape that we're familiar with, the language is sometimes unfamiliar. I mean, soliloquy here, to be or not to be, aye, there's the point. That doesn't sound quite like the speech we know. Within a year or so, a new version of Hamlet, again in the little quarto paperback type format, hit the stands. The Tragical History of Hamlet, Prince of Denmark by William Shakespeare, newly imprinted and enlarged to almost as much again as it was, according to the true and perfect copy. So this is maybe Shakespeare, maybe his acting company, we don't know for sure, saying, actually, that text was corrupt. It may reflect the length of the play as it was first performed, but the wording was all wrong. Here, almost twice as long, 4,000 lines, is the full text. And this seems to be the text that is closest to Shakespeare's working manuscript. In a way, it is the literary text.
So this is sort of saying, don't believe everything you've read. You know, you've heard of the play. This is the actual play. This is what Shakespeare wrote. His hand is on this.
Exactly so. Now, you would have thought, with that kind of claim, that sort of authority, when it came to the folio, all they would do was simply tell the printer, well, just copy out that second quarto of Hamlet. But they didn't. They chose a different script. They chose a script based on the prompt book in the theatre. And we find that that's lost about 200-300 lines, including one or two really key moments, notably Hamlet's big last soliloquy, the soliloquy he speaks as Fortinbras's army is marching across Poland. That is completely cut in the folio version. So it looks as if at some point in the theatre life of the play, it was realised this play is too long to be staged in full, and the actors started hacking away at it. A play is a thing that changes. Scholars nowadays sometimes talk about the mobile texts of Shakespeare's plays, and that means it's always a little bit of a guess as to which version we should prefer. What we've done in the new edition is we've said, well, we don't really know how authoritative the quartos are or are not, but what we do know, because of Hemings and Condor's involvement, because of what they say, that the first folio text is an authorised text. It's the text that Shakespeare's actors wanted to be gathered together and reproduced as a kind of memorial to Shakespeare.
This is a change, isn't it, from many editorial directions. I mean, really, since the 18th century, pretty much. Editors have tried to, the jargon word is conflate. I mean, some of us might say couple together as best they can to try and come up with a kind of perfect version. This is different.
Yeah, that's right. I mean, the process of editing, I mean, what does that mean? Well, it means modernising the spelling, not changing the words. We don't change thee and thou to you. But we modernise the old spelling, we modernise the typography, we correct obvious printer's errors, we also write explanatory notes explaining the difficult language. All that sort of work, which we call editing, that began for Shakespeare at the beginning of the 1700s, the 18th century. It began with an edition in six volumes by Nicholas Rowe, who was the poet laureate. And he was the first to do this correcting and modernising of the text. A few years after him, a rival edition appeared, edited by the great poet Alexander Pope. And Pope was the first to begin to look seriously at both the quartos and the folio, to see the variance between them, and to adopt what I call this pick and mix approach, preferring some quarto readings, some folio readings. And really it has been the case that almost all editions since that of Pope have chosen the quarto text as the basis for some plays, the folio as the basis for other, and in many cases have, on a line-by-line basis, moved between the two texts. And it's that tradition, that sort of three centuries of editorial work that we're overturning.
I think it's the last clean-up of Victorian bowdlerism, of that censorship of the Victorians over Shakespeare. It's astonishing it's taken this long. But finally, we are in scholarly editions as opposed to in dirty-minded rehearsal rooms. We're actually owning up to the full range and richness of thought. I think politically, it's much more sophisticated than any previous editions, who always had half an eye on merry old England and wasn't at all super-duper. And this is the first major edition that's faced up to the fact that the England of Good Queen Bess was in some senses a hellhole, and that Shakespeare's work reflects that.
For a long time, Shakespeare was admired by critics and scholars, above all as a poet. And so the version that seemed closest to the poet's hand was the one that they preferred. The folio, with the emphasis on the staging, there's been a little bit of a tradition among academics, scholars and editors of saying, you know, Shakespeare's too good for the theatre, let's have the more pristine version, the draft straight from his hand, rather than the version that the bookkeeper, the stage manager, has got hold of.
Could you give us an example of how that kind of detailed textual work actually helps when you're in the rehearsal room with modern actors at the RSC? I notice you've got a script there of a recent RSC production directed by Greg Doran.
I've just got here the prompt book from Greg's production of The Taming of the Shrew.
So this is a little bit like a kind of modern equivalent of some of the text that the folio is based on. This is the kind of the working theatrical version.
Exactly, that's right. So this is, it's in a loose leaf binder. It's a typed up text, but it's got lots of instructions on pages opposite the text, giving stage directions and telling the actors, the blocking, telling them where they move. It's a very interesting theatre document, and as you say, in some sense, an equivalent to the prompt books that were used by the editors of the first folio. But there's a particular detail that to me is really interesting. The key scene in The Taming of a Shrew is the first scene where Kate and Petruchio are together alone and they start sort of bantering with each other. Now, the prompt book, Greg based on a modern edition of the play, and it has their dialogue, and then we see at the end of their dialogue here, a stage direction, re-enter Baptista, Gremio and Tranio. Baptista is Kate's father. So the banter comes to an end with Petruchio saying that he's going to marry her. I'm born to tame you, Kate, bring you from a wild Kate to a Kate conformable as other household Kates. I must and will have Catherine to my wife. Enter the father. So that was how they began rehearsing it. But Greg actually likes to have a facsimile of the folio in the rehearsal room. And as they were working on it, he looked down at the folio and saw that actually in the folio, this entrance of the father, Baptista, Gremio and Tranio, comes halfway through Petruchio's speech. They noticed this in the rehearsal room and thought, well, let's try it like that. They did try it like that, and they saw that maybe those lines are written in such a way that they are meant to be overheard, that Petruchio and Kate are actually at this point have come to a little tacit agreement with themselves that they're going to play a game of Taming of the Shrew. And this altered the whole interpretation of the production. It made Greg and his team see that maybe you can read Kate and Petruchio as engaged in a kind of game of taming for the benefit of their family and society at large. And that all came from looking in the original folio and seeing that a stage direction was maybe four lines earlier than it was in the modern edited text that they began with.
I mean, what kind of work have you done with actors and with, you mentioned Greg, other people perhaps?
Yeah, I mean, yes, with Greg and Michael, some of the other directors and some of the actors. The main way in which it's been helpful is whenever I've got stuck, instead of just sort of going to other scholars, I've been able to go to people who have directed the plays and said, how did you solve this problem in the theatre? What the RSC are going to do from now on is use these texts as the kind of base text to begin from in the rehearsal room. They will form the prompt books for future productions. But of course, directors will go on cutting, reshaping, making their own choices, even rewriting. That's always happened with Shakespeare. It's one of the things that keeps Shakespeare alive, the way that the theatre feels free to take liberties of interpretation, of setting, of cutting, and indeed of alteration. There's no sense in which this modernised folio text we've produced is going to be a sort of prescriptive text, but I think it's going to be a very interesting starting point. And already a number of directors are saying how fantastic they find it to have that as the starting point.
Every single director, every single company, every single generation, you know, has to discover Shakespeare for itself, and different things in the text will speak to a particular director or to a particular moment. It's always that dialogue between the two. And when you actually get a lot of genius in the room that meets Shakespeare's genius, he always comes out on top. But it is always a meeting of minds across the centuries, and that's what makes doing classical theatre so fascinating.
Guardian Unlimited.